We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Just a couple of weeks ago, we had the hearings for Elena Kagan, who's been nominated to the Supreme Court. And we heard a kind of criticism of this process that we've been hearing now for some time. In recent years, more and more people seem to be saying that they think that the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court have become empty exercises. They say, well, nominees don't really want to say anything controversial, nothing that would jeopardize their confirmation. So these critics contend the nominees try not to say very much at all. Our guest for this hour, Lori Ringhand, who's professor of law at University of Georgia, has come to a slightly different conclusion. She has co-authored a study that looks back over the past 70 years and says, actually, you can find some interesting things. If you take a look at what was discussed, certainly, she says, you can learn a lot about the times in which they take place, about what issues really concerned people. So this morning we'll talk about how these hearings have changed over time and what you can learn if you take a close look. And of course, questions here on the program are welcome. The study that we're talking about is called May It Please the Senate, an Empirical Analysis of the Senate Judiciary Committee Hearings of Supreme Court Nominees 1939 to 2009, just for the record. And Lori Ringhand, our guest, she is Associate Professor of Law at University of Georgia School of Law. She is the co-author, along with Paul Collins, who teaches political science at University of North Texas. She's joining us this morning by telephone, and questions are welcome now. Please, we ask people who are calling in with questions to keep it to a question, keep it brief and keep it on the topic. Otherwise, though, questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll free, 800-222-9455. And you may also send your question by email. Just write to will-talk@illinois.edu, and we'd be very happy to have it. And Professor Ringhand, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. I think that a lot of interesting things here that we'll talk about. But just to start off, I think that you've done something that, at my understanding is here, at least it's significant in that nobody had ever done this before, attempted to look back over all of these hearings and look at what people said and then put that into a searchable database so that scholars, anybody who is interested, can actually go back and take a look at the questions that were posed and the answers that the nominees gave.
That's right. There's been a lot of research and a lot of scholarly and public interest in the confirmation process, but there was really surprisingly little empirical data about what actually happened at the hearings. So what my co-author and I did was we went back to 1939, which was the year that Felix Frankfurter appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and it was the first year at which a nominee appeared and took open, unrestricted questions from the senators in a public hearing. So we took that as our starting point, and we coded into a data set every question asked and every answer given at every hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, committee since that point, which gave us just a tremendous resource to take a real hard empirical look at what's actually happening so we can make better choices and have better informed discussions about what role the hearings are having in the process.
Yeah. You, in the article here, you talk a little bit about, write a little bit about the history of confirmation hearings, and I found it interesting that, in fact, that the Senate Judiciary Committee was established relatively early in the 19th century, and for the first 100 years, no nominee appeared before the committee.
That's right. It wasn't the norm for a nominee to appear and testify before the Senate vote was taken, which is partially just logistics of traveling in the 1800s, frankly. It wasn't that easy to get to and fro. But one thing that I think is worth noting, when you hear something like that, that the nominees didn't appear, sometimes there's an assumption implied in that that these hearings and judicial appointments, Supreme Court appointments, were not controversial in the past. That's certainly not the case. What we see looking back much further back than our data set goes, back to the, you know, George Washington's presidency, Supreme Court nominees have always been controversial. The rejection rate was actually even higher prior to 1900 than it's been since then. Prior to 1900, about 30% of nominees were either rejected by the Senate or they withdrew before a vote was taken. That's down a little bit to about 21% since 1900.
Hmm. The other thing that I think is interesting here is that it seems that particularly in recent years, going back to, and I think probably the benchmark here were the hearings for Judge Bork, which we can talk a little bit more in a minute. But it seems that ever since that point, people have been complaining about the process and have been pointing to this tendency of nominees not to really want to say much of anything. But it also seems to be the case that this kind of complaint that is that I mentioned at the beginning, that is people who are saying, oh, this is just an empty exercise, that's really not new.
I think that's correct. Well, I think it's partially correct. I think there's a couple of things that have gone on in roughly the last 30 to 40 years that have influenced the way we think about confirmation hearings. First of all, they're televised, so we all see them now. Secondly, senators are increasingly responsive to public opinion. You know, it wasn't that long ago when senators were actually appointed through the state legislatures and didn't have to care very much what their constituents directly thought. That need for senators to respond more directly and immediately to public opinion has driven part of the change that we've seen. Televising the hearings, I think, has driven part of the change that we've seen. And we have, in perhaps the period since World War II, moved into a more partisan environment than we had prior to that. Certainly historically not the current level of partisanship is not off the charts, but we had been through a period where there was roughly, generally speaking, a lower degree of partisanship. All those things have combined to make the confirmation hearings a little more high profile and make the controversies about them more public rather than things that just kind of go on behind the Senate's doors.
Mm-hmm. And then it seems that again, not to go on endlessly about this history, but
yeah.
But that from the point when the very first person, I think it was Felix Frankfurter, you said it was the very first person, and this was in the 20s, then it was sort of irregular until maybe it was at about the 50s at some point where from that point on, then every nominee came and went through the business.
That's right. Felix Frankfurter's hearing was in 1939. They were hit or miss in terms of public appearance before the committee until about the early 50s. And since then, every nominee who's been appointed and who hasn't withdrawn has appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
I want to talk here a second about the hearings for Judge Bork.
Mm-hmm.
He was nominated to the court by Ronald Reagan. This was 1987.
Mm-hmm.
The Senate rejected the nomination. Mm-hmm. And certainly he, because he of his record, was a controversial figure. At least there were a lot of people who were politically on the left who were opposed to him. Based on his record, there was a great fear that would he become a member of the court, he would vote, and it came up, he would vote to overturn Roe. That was the thing everybody was concerned about. And, of course, in his appearance before the Senate, he was not shy about talking about what he believed. And certainly after that, you would say, well, you know, agree or disagree, you would have to say there's no question where he stands. And I think a lot of people look at that and say that this was something kind of exceptional. And certainly they would say that he was so open and so combative that really doomed his nomination. What you find when you look back through the record is that actually that this is not how that whole all went down is not that exceptional.
That's right. There's a lot to say about Bork. One of the things, first of all, what we see when we look at the Bork hearing, it wasn't really dominated by abortion questions. Abortion actually plays a smaller role in the hearings since Roe v. Wade was decided than we might have expected. Secondly, about Bork, though, in terms of just the ultimate outcome, he was anomalous within his little window of time. But again, lots of nominees had been rejected prior to and or withdrawn. Nixon had a lot of trouble with nominees. You know, difficult nominees and rejected nominees have a long and storied history in this process. So just the fact of rejecting a nominee, and the fact of rejecting a nominee because of his constitutional positions really wasn't that unusual. It was just unusual within that kind of period of time. We hadn't done it for a while. We also find, though, the story you just told about Justice or Judge Bork's confirmation hearing, that he answered questions, he was rejected, and therefore nominees ever since haven't asked questions. Well, this isn't really in our data. This just comes from reading all of these transcripts. My sense is that Judge Bork did answer questions, and he did it in a combative way, which certainly hurt him. But what we see is that the nominees since him have actually answered many of the same types of questions. They've frankly just given different answers. And they've given answers that are more consistent with where the kind of constitutional consensus of the country sits right now. And I think that's really important because it gets at one of the key reasons that we developed this database, was we wanted to look at the ways in which public opinion mediated through the senators helped shape constitutional law. And what we see is that the issues discussed and the ways in which they're discussed change over time. And there are certain things that become kind of deeply embedded, constitutional, accepted truths, for lack of a better word. And subsequent nominees have to validate those things. And if they don't, they're going to run into trouble. Justice Judge Bork didn't validate those things, and he ran into trouble.
So what I think is really interesting here is that it raises, ultimately, I think in my mind, it raises the question, well, what exactly is the purpose of these hearings?
That's right.
And is that just about assessing the suitability of the nominee, or do they actually become opportunities to really debate issues? And can you actually say that the hearings ultimately have an effect on how the court operates and how we think about constitutional law?
Right. Well, we certainly believe the latter. And as this project and our work with this database goes forward, we hope to be able to quantify that a little bit more. But what the story of the Supreme Court is really this. We tend to think of the Supreme Court as very anomalous within our governing system. We think of it as comprised of these unelected and therefore completely unaccountable justices who hand down constitutional law and then the rest of us just have to live with it. Well, if that's the story of what the Supreme Court's doing, then it makes sense that we have such a desire in our political dialogue for constitutional law to be something firm and settled and findable, right? That a good justice, if she just works hard enough, can go out there being completely objective and find something called the law. Because if they're really this unaccountable, completely isolated entity, then we want the law to be something that's solid, because if it's not, then they're just, as we've all heard, imposing their personal opinions on the rest of us. On the other hand, if the Supreme Court isn't quite that isolated and isn't quite that unaccountable, but rather if public opinion over time, and I stress over time, helps shape constitutional law and build constitutional norms, Then if constitutional law is a little bit squishier, if the right answer isn't out there, like they said in the X-Files, we can be maybe a little more comfortable with that, because we know that we will, over time, as a people, shape the way con law develops.
Well, that raises all kinds of interesting questions in my mind. I guess the first impulse I have, though, is to say that the senators in their questioning of the nominees seem to want to get them to talk about how they would likely rule on particular sorts of issues. Mm-hmm. And nominees, of course, they're very careful to say, well, I don't want to speak to that right now. I can't speak to that right now. But you get the sense that they're also interested, that is, the senators are interested in the nominee's respect for precedent,
right,
and how likely it is that they might overturn,
right,
a decision of a previous court. And it seems like the nominees are trying one way or another really to indicate their respect for a precedent, so that they're not likely to go in there, the proverbial bull in the china shop, and start really upsetting what has for some time been settled law.
Right. Well, then both the nominees and the senators are actually in a pretty tough position, because I think to get kind of back to your initial question, what these hearings are about is both talking about the development of constitutional law and validating or challenging existing constitutional consensuses. So what that means is that the nominees and the senators, in order to be really fulfilling that role, have to talk about the constitutional consequences of the nominees' constitutional vision of how they approach con law. That's a very important part of what this process is doing. Show me the consequences of what your vision of the Constitution will be. On the other hand, there is a very genuine concern, which is not just about trying to avoid controversy, that judges do, or justices in this case, really do have a professional obligation to hear arguments with an open mind. And part of the, at least appearance, of hearing arguments with an open mind means not saying before you even hear the argument what you're going to decide. So it is a fine line to draw. I actually think Senator Lindsey Graham, in the profile that the New York Times Magazine did on him a few weeks ago, probably a month ago now, actually hit this balance pretty well. And what he said was, my job as a senator is to make sure that the people listening, his constituents, all of us, understand what it means to nominate a person with this constitutional approach, and then they can decide whether they like that or not. And I think that that's just about right. The job of the Senate is to make sure that people see and understand the constitutional battles, and then also, and distinctly, to use the process to validate constitutional changes that have become part of our constitutional consensus.
Hmm. Just to go back to a second for something that you really already talked about, because, again, I also think that it's really something really interesting to think about, and that is challenging this notion that we have that the court is existing on some sort of rarefied plane up above everybody else, and that all they're supposed to be doing is considering the law, all of what has gone before, legally speaking, going all the way back to the guys who wrote the Constitution, and that's it. And clearly, that the court really is and has been influenced by public opinion. They're not that isolated, in spite of the kind of arguments that people make about this approach to the Constitution that says, look, it is what it is, it says what it says, these guys back there, that's the way they wrote it, and this is what they had in mind, and it's not up to me or anybody else to come along and reinterpret that or say, well, yeah, that's what they thought then, but this is a different time, you know, all that kind of stuff, that in fact that the court has in many ways responded to national moods and how people think about things, and that, you know, as much as we say that that's the other kind of thing is supposed to be the way they operate, in fact, that's not the way they operate.
Right. Well, you know, of course what justices consider is the law. The problem is when you're dealing with the Constitution, the law doesn't actually tell you very much. I like to tell my students the Constitution is an argument. And in many ways, it really is. The fiber, the terms of the Constitution, the parts that we argue about are things, words like equal protection and due process and freedom of speech. And these phrases, they're written at a very open, very abstract level. So what the court, as the arbitrator of constitutional meaning, has to do is figure out how those terms, how the values they embody, apply to specific situations today. And they do that. If they did that, if what they were doing was just saying, well, this is what I think the right answer is, that would be constitutionally problematic, if that's what they were doing and if that was the final say. But, of course, their approaches, their visions of constitutionalism are mediated through this electorally accountable process of the confirmation hearings, and they change over time, which makes the exercise of discretion, which really is just necessary given the way the Constitution is written, a less troubling proposition. And in terms of the original meaning, they wrote the words they wrote. It's really interesting when you start studying constitutional history. That argument breaks down. Not always. There are situations where we can know what an originally intended application of a constitutional text was, but there's an awful lot where we can't. And there's an awful lot where the authors, the founding fathers themselves, disagreed. And constitutional language, like almost all language written by political entities or perhaps by any group of people, you abstract it up to the highest level necessary to get agreement. So everyone could agree that the president should be 35 years of age before he can be eligible to hold office. That's nice and specific because that's easy. No one really knew for sure if the national government with its new powers could do things like charter a national bank. So what do we get instead of specificity? We get the Commerce Clause. Congress can regulate interstate commerce among the states. That's a much higher level of abstraction, and it's higher because there wasn't necessarily underlying foundational agreement.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Laurie Ringhand. She is Associate Professor of Law at the University of Georgia School of Law, where she teaches constitutional law, among other things. And she is the co-author of a study called May It Please the Senate, which takes a look at hearings for the Supreme Court held in the Senate Judiciary Committee, going all the way back to when we had the first of these hearings, taking a look at what was discussed and something of the quality of this conversation, and asked this question, well, what sort of things can you learn by taking a close look at this? And this is something that really hadn't been done before, and what she and her co-author, Paul Collins, he's a professor of political science at University of Texas, have done is actually put together a searchable database so that in future people have these kinds of questions or perhaps would like to take a look at a justice, a member of the court, and then go back and look at, well, what did this person say when they had their hearings, and did that, how predictive was that of the kind of justice that he or she turned out to be? Well, you can use this database, and you can actually do that. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to talk a little bit more about some of the things that you found, and I guess that one of the things that you tried to look at was over time something about what were the exchanges like between the senators and the nominee. And I think that some people have this idea that maybe what this should be, what the hearing should be, is a graduate level seminar in constitutional law. Is that in fact what these things turn out to be?
Well, it's interesting. When we first started this project, there's a famous database out there, the U.S. Supreme Court database done by Harold Spaeth and Jeff Siegel. And that database codes Supreme Court's decisions by issue groups. And we thought out, we started out this project thinking, oh, that's great. We're going to make our coding match theirs, so we can see directly how what the senators talk about ties back to constitutional law cases. Well, it turns out that senators don't talk the language of constitutional law. Senators, perhaps this shouldn't have surprised us, talk the language of politics. So we had to go find a different database so we could have coding that matched the language of political issues before it's kind of legalized by the Supreme Court in its cases. And what we saw, several interesting things. We found, first of all, that the most common type of comment at the hearings is what we call chatter, frankly. Mm-hmm. 35% of the hearings in our data, over the comments in our database, are just nominees and senators making polite chit-chat back and forth with each other. So that actually ends up to be the biggest chunk of thing that happens at these hearings. But we also found, perhaps more substantively, we found that back all the way back to 1939, questions of judicial philosophy, questions saying, you know, how do you believe the Constitution should be interpreted, have never been a majority of the questions asked. In other words, the majority of the questions asked all the way through 1939 have been substantive questions. This matters because it's part of our debate about what we think is wrong with the hearings. We frequently hear various people arguing the senators should just ask questions about judicial philosophy. They shouldn't ask about specific issues. You know, that's one of the things that's identified as having gone wrong. Well, that's always been the case. The dominant questioning patterns have always been about particular issues. Mm-hmm. Now, what those issues are have varied over time. Within the data set as a whole, the most common issue discussed is civil rights. That includes race, gender, age discrimination. It includes abortion. It includes freedom of religion and freedom of speech. Questions on those issues have really substantively dominated the hearings, particularly since the 1970s. We also see a lot of questions about criminal justice, crime, and a decent subset of questions about judicial philosophy. So they're in there, but they don't dominate the hearings.
Well, I think one of the things that's interesting, given just how controversial an issue abortion is, mm-hmm. that one would think that, and about how, you know, how many people are concerned with either overturning Roe or preserving Roe, you'd think that would have been a really big thing over the past couple of decades. And while that is something that gets in there in your civil rights category, it seems that, in fact, discussion of abortion was not a big topic.
You know, it's actually pretty limited. Even accounting for the fact that Roe v. Wade didn't make abortion a constitutional issue until the 1970s, even accounting for that in the era post-Roe, only about 5% of the comments in the database involve abortion. And we actually defined an abortion-related question fairly broadly because as those of us who watch the hearings kind of obsessively know, abortion is often it's dealt with through proxy issues. We talk about privacy. We talk about a case called Griswold v. Connecticut that involved contraception. So even including those types of comments within the abortion category, it just hasn't played the enormous role, at least at the hearings, that one might have suspected.
Mm. I think it's also really interesting, again, when you look at this breakdown of the things that people were talking about, a dramatic sort of a turn there was, I guess maybe it would have been right about 1971. Mm-hmm. Now, before, certainly there were times when people were talking about issues of civil rights, mm-hmm. in the late 50s and in the late 60s. But it seems that right from 1971 on, up to the hearings for Judge Sotomayor, mm-hmm. that civil rights was the issue.
That's right. Since 1971, which was the hearing of Justice Powell, from that point forward, every single nominee has faced more questions about civil rights issues than they have about any other issue. Prior to that, the issue that dominated had been a little bit more mixed. Sometimes crime would dominate, sometimes civil rights would dominate, sometimes, you know, judicial philosophy dominated in a couple of them prior to 1971. But since 1971, civil rights has been the most pressing issue, which isn't really surprising, right? Because the 70s, of course, the late 60s and the 70s, were really when women and minority groups started operationalizing their own constitutional rights and really pushed a lot of those issues to the forefront of the country's agenda.
Although it's also, you want to take this apart a little bit, and you do, there are a lot of things that can come under the big umbrella of civil rights.
Yes,
so
there certainly are.
Then you have to ask, well, what sort of issues are people talking about? And in fact, there has been an interesting kind of shift over time in what it is that people are really concerned with.
That's right. The civil rights questions have changed over time. They for much of the time period from 1971 until about the mid-80s, they were dominated by questions about racial discrimination. That was clearly the most pressing civil rights issue area within the hearings during that time frame. What we've seen since the mid-80s is that questions of race within the civil rights category have actually kind of leveled off and gone down a little bit, while questions of gender and sexual orientation discrimination have kind of risen up to fill the gap. So there's been a little bit of a shift within civil rights. Both of those issue areas continue to be important at the hearings, but we see a little tamping down of questions about racial discrimination.
It's also interesting you take a look at the interaction between the nominee and the senators.
Right.
And ask this question, well, what do you see if you look at Republicans and Democrats, for example, if you just break it down that way? And it would seem that, for example, in the hearings for Elaine Kagan, that some of the senators, and I think that pretty much they were the Republican senators, seemed to be very frustrated with the reluctance of the nominee to respond to their questions to their satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure if we went back in time and we had a nominee that would be generally considered to be conservative, I'm guessing that in that case it would be the Democratic senators who would be essentially doing the same thing. Yeah, I'm sure we can go back to Mr. Justice Roberts, for example, and we could find the same kinds of things with Democratic senators, you know, being very frustrated and going on about, oh, you're not answering my questions and you won't answer me. And, I'm sure that it does depend on what's the orientation of the perceived orientation of the nominee, and then what's where on the political spectrum does that senator sit?
Yeah, it does seem that the degree of responsiveness that the senators expect turns on a dime depending on who's sitting in front of them. It is kind of fun to watch them try to work with that. Now, there have been some exceptions to that. Senator Specter, in particular, who has sat on the Judiciary Committee both as a Republican and as a Democratic senator, was always very insistent on really kind of trying to stake out the Senate's advice and consent role. But within our database, we do see some interesting distinctions between the behavior of Republican senators and the behavior of Democratic senators. It's one of the things that we tracked within the database. And first of all, on the civil rights issue, what we see is that senators of the opposite party of the nominee's appointing president ask more questions about civil rights. So what appears to be going on there is that a senator who is perhaps presumptively not in agreement with the nominee's position on civil rights pushes hard on those issue areas. So if you're a Democratic nominee facing a Republican senator, chances are you're going to get a lot of civil rights questions from that senator. The other thing we see that's quite interesting, there are differences regardless of the party of the appointing president of the nominee. There are some differences in the types of questions asked by Republican senators and the types of questions asked by Democratic senators. We see Republican senators overall ask more questions about judicial philosophy, while Democratic senators ask more specific questions about things like criminal justice. And my co-author and I found that really interesting because, in a way, it may be evidence of a pretty sophisticated political calculation on the part of the senators,
mm-hmm.
because both Republican senators and Democratic senators appear to be playing to their strengths. Republican senators like to talk about judicial interpretation and just follow the law, don't use your discretion, follow the law, do what the founders wanted. Those are very popular slogans in our public dialogue. So the Republican senators really stress that. Democratic senators, on the other hand, tend to be more consequentialist. They stress, you know, do you think that women's gender equality is important? Do you think that discrimination should be subject to heightened scrutiny under the Equal Protection Clause? They talk the language of a more substantive agenda, which at least some polling indicates is actually more, their agenda is more popular on the specifics, whereas the agenda of the right is more popular on the abstract. So both parties are kind of playing to their strengths. Although, again, even among the Republican nominees, judicial philosophy is still a relatively small percentage of the overall questions asked.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Lori Ringhand. She's professor of law, associate professor of law at the University of Georgia Law School. She teaches constitutional law and other things there, and she is the co-author of a paper that we're talking about here that takes a look at Senate Judiciary Committee hearings for Supreme Court nominees, going all the way back to when the very first of these were held. That would have been in 1939. Looking at what it is, the kind of questions that senators asked and what it is that the nominees said. And what she and her co-author have done is that they put together a database looking at this so that if people would like to go back and look at what were the issues that seemed to be most important, or what did the nominees say, that's now possible to do. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. You may send along your questions by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Another thing that you found that was interesting is that you took a look at the kinds of questions that were asked and the interaction between the nominee and the senators, and looked at what difference it made when the nominee was either male or female and their ethnic background.
Right. That was actually one of the more interesting things that we found in our study. What we saw was that women and minority nominees really face a different confirmation environment than more traditional nominees do. And specifically, I mentioned a while ago about the chatter category, the kind of social chit-chat between the nominees and the senators that we coded for. Well, one of the things that we found was that women and minority nominees face statistically significant less chatter than do their counterparts. And what's interesting about that is it shows that the senators appear to be approaching those nominations perhaps a little bit more formally. There's less of the casualness, the back and forth, the kind of chummy chatter that we see in the other hearings. The consequence of that is that women and minority nominees really, as a percentage of questioning, are facing a higher percentage of substantive questions. We also saw that female nominees face more questions about their judicial philosophy, and minority nominees face more questions, again, all to the level of statistical significance. Minority nominees face more questions about criminal justice matters.
I guess I'm sure that there are people who will look at that and say, well, that's really not surprising that the senators are basically white guys, and that that they might be more comfortable if the nominee was also a white guy.
Well, of course, I mean, our data, of course, don't tell us why this is happening, but I think there's a couple of reasons, and the reasons play out, the kind of hypothesized reasons play out in different ways. One could very easily be just the senator's own comfort level. If they're feeling a little bit uncomfortable, they may default to a more formal interaction. It also could be that women or minority nominees are more likely to come to the Senate with an advocacy background. They've worked for certain types of groups. They've worked for civil rights groups. Justice Ginsburg, of course, famously worked for women's rights groups. And perhaps that type of background simply gives the senators more to chew on as they're going through the questioning. So there's lots of potential reasons for it, but it plainly is happening that women and minority nominees or nominees of color really are facing a different type of environment.
We have a caller. Let's bring them in. In Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good Good morning.
Yes.
I'm wondering if the database is going to show, do you think, some changes since Bush v. Gore and the rise, let's say, of the conservative activist in the line of Scalia at the time or Roberts now, which will cause the concerns for stare decisis to shift over to the Democrats?
That's a really interesting question. We haven't seen that reflected yet in the data set, but what we certainly do see happening at the Supreme Court level, and you saw a little shadow of this in the Kagan hearings, which I'll talk about in just a moment, but what you do see is that what it means to be a conservative justice has really changed over perhaps the last 40 years. When Justice Rehnquist was the lone conservative on the bench in the 70s, what it meant to be a conservative justice and why he was considered so conservative was that he was consistently voting to not extend constitutional rights. What you see now, Justice Thomas sitting on the court has I believe at the moment is the most conservative voting record. I'm not sure about Justice Alito. He just hasn't been there long enough for us to know yet. But what you see now is votes that are being cast as conservative, their votes to extend different types of constitutional rights. So in other words, the caller used the word activist. What you see is that it's now frequently the more substantively conservative justices who are using judicial power to strike down legislation. They're using judicial power to strike down legislation in the name of free speech in the campaign finance regulation cases. They're using it to strike down regulation in voluntarily enacted affirmative action programs. It's a much more proactive use of judicial power. That used to be associated with liberal justices. Now it's much more associated with conservative justices and the liberal justices, and again, there's some variation among issues, but the liberal justices are more likely to be casting liberal votes in that they are simply voting to uphold liberal legislation or legislation they think is liberal or deemed liberal.
Does that, caller, get at your question? I hope so. This, I think, again, is really interesting because there has been so much conversation about activism, and that's a term that gets tossed around. And certainly it is true that one can be a liberal activist, one can be a conservative activist, but it seems now that the right really owns that term and uses it to more often as a way to condemn what they consider to be liberal activism, and where in fact we do have a court here that it's a very conservative court and hasn't shied away from being activist in the way that conservatives can be activists.
Right, and so much it's actually a word that in some ways we should banish from our discussion because nobody really knows what it means anymore.
Uh-huh.
The kind of classic political science definition of an activist judge is one who uses judicial power to strike down democratically enacted legislation. If that's your definition, there's no question that the more conservative justices sitting on the court today are more activists. Mm-hmm. That's a shift from where we were in the 60s and 70s when the liberal justices were more likely to use their power to strike down legislation. Now, of course, not everyone will accept that that's the appropriate definition of the word activist. Some people say what the word activist is, what you're doing when you're being an activist judge, is you're imposing your own values instead of the law of the Constitution. The difficulty with that definition is that it's really not provable in any way. It's really just another way of restating substantive disagreement with the decision. So if you're looking for an objective definition, striking down legislation is not a bad one, and it's plainly the conservative justices who are doing that, and they're doing it in issue areas, as I mentioned, such as the First Amendment, campaign finance regulation, affirmative action, that cluster of issue areas they're striking down legislation in.
We have just about 5 minutes left here. Our guest is Lori Ringhand. She is Associate Professor of Law at University of Georgia. We're talking about the Supreme Court. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just before responding to the question of the last caller, you said something that about maybe you might want to say some things about the Kagan hearings. And I don't know if there was anything in particular you thought interesting and about those hearings.
Yeah, well, one of the things that we saw in the Kagan hearings, which was interesting for law geeks, you saw the revival of the Commerce Clause. And most of your listeners, I'm willing to bet, are not very familiar with the Commerce Clause. But the Commerce Clause is one of the parts of the Constitution that gives Congress power to legislate. We all know from our high school civics classes that under our constitutional regime, the federal government only has the powers that the Constitution gives to it, whereas the states have all powers except those that the Constitution takes away. Well, one of the most important constitutional grants of power to Congress is the Commerce Clause, which gives Congress the power to regulate things in interstate commerce among the states. The Commerce Clause has gotten a little bit sexy lately because what we see is that it's tied in with the big healthcare debate, because the Congress passed the healthcare legislation under the power of both the Commerce Clause and the Tax and Spend Clause, another one of those real popular ones. And so we suddenly saw a lot of discussion about how broadly the nominee thought the Commerce Clause should be interpreted. What the senators were plainly trying to get at here was an understanding of whether she would hold that the new health care legislation was within congressional power. Mm-hmm.
We talked, or I mentioned the fact that you had been involved in putting together this database, and that part of the idea was that then it would make it possible for scholars to look at members of the court and look at how they rule and what they say, and then also go back and look at what they said during their confirmation hearings,
right,
and be able to, you know, answer some questions about, well, how revealing were they? Did they in fact say things that you could say, well, look, here they said this, and then when they were a member of the court, they actually sort of did what they said. It was in line with what they said.
Right.
And I just wondered to what extent you've been able to start doing that and look at how predictive comments of the nominees are.
Right. It's because nominees tend to be a little more evasive at the highly particular level at which Supreme Court cases are decided, it's a little bit tricky. But what we definitely see is that one can actually get a pretty good sense of who a justice is going to be, about what the general trends of their constitutional decisions are going to be, by what they say at their hearings. They actually are fairly revealing. My favorite example of this is Justice Kennedy's hearings. Justice Kennedy, for your listeners who don't remember, he ended up with Judge Bork's seat. That was Justice Kennedy ultimately won the seat that Judge Bork lost. And when you read Justice Kennedy's nomination transcript, particularly in comparison to Bork, you're not going to be at all surprised by the justice he turned out to be. He talks about the Constitution and constitutional meaning as derived from a wide variety of sources. He says it's unrealistic to think that one can look at or find an original meaning of text to answer the most difficult constitutional questions of today. He talks about a very expansive sense of constitutional liberty, which has clearly come out in many of his decisions in areas of sexual orientation, gay rights, that cluster of kind of personal privacy issues. It really is all in there. He's not talking like none of the nominees talk at a highly specific level, but clearly his vision of constitutional law and the role of the courts was very different than Judge Bork's, and I think we see that manifested in his decisions.
Mm. If you take a look at the Constitution and you look at that section of the Constitution that sets out the judiciary, mm-hmm. the court, it's really short.
It's really short.
It doesn't really say that much. And so what has happened over time is that institution has evolved, and particular justices have been very important in shaping the court and what it looks like and how it operates, so mm-hmm. that there so that tradition then has become very important, much more important than what the document says. Having said that, it does say this one basic thing that essentially is interpreted to mean, as long as justices behave themselves and they can function, they're there.
That's right.
But that also there have been some interesting things in recent years suggested about, you know, changing the way the court operates, and one of them being a suggestion that maybe this idea of lifetime term doesn't exactly serve us as well as it should. Do you think that it's possible that we might ever see any really dramatic changes in the way that the court operates?
Right. Lifetime tenure is a tough question. Part of what's going on, of course, is when the Constitution was written, people didn't live as long. Mm-hmm. So the idea that someone would sit on the court routinely for, 30 to 40 years probably is a little bit different than the expectation of the Constitution writers when they put lifetime tenure in the Constitution. Now, on the other hand, it's not clear that it's mattered a whole lot. There's a great little book by Barry Friedman called The Will of the People. And what that book does is it tracks the ways in which important Supreme Court decisions have kind of kept pace with long-lasting, deep-seated public opinion. Not the fly-by-the-night, the kind of off-the-seat-of-your-pants public opinion, but public opinion on issues that lasts for, a decade or longer tends to be reflected in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence. So it's not clear that the longer tenure of justices has actually gotten the court wildly out of whack with what our vision of our Constitution is as a nation. Secondly, there's the problem if you eliminate life tenure, you create some incentives for judicial behavior that we might want to be a bit cautious about. A justice who doesn't have life tenure is going to leave the court and want to have another job. And we want to be really careful about what types of incentives we're creating for people who have to go back out into the world and find another position. These are very high-level, very politically connected people. You don't want to create a sense of indebtedness to their partisan affiliates or political allies so they can get a prestigious ambassadorship or something once they leave. You don't want to create that sense of reward.
Yeah. Well, we're at the point here we're going to have to finish up. It's been an interesting conversation, and I thank you very much for giving us some of your time today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Our guest, Lori Ringhan, she is Associate Professor of Law at the University of Georgia School of Law.